Thank you all for coming. Good to see you. Last time, we made the point that there are three essential conflicts between science and religion. First, of course, as you well know, is the issue of creation versus eternity of the universe. Second issue is the age of the universe, 12.2 to 15 billion years, as opposed to Torah's age, which is 5764, which is the traditional age, let's say. And three, the natural ascent of mankind versus divine creation, or the issue of evolution. We easily solved the first issue since 1957, when Arnio Penzias, from New Jersey, of course, along with a good friend, Mr. Wilson, Dr. Wilson, discovered background radiation, which was attributable only to, good to see you, only to the Big Bang. It's become almost universally accepted, agreed upon, nobody questions this, that there was some form of a Big Bang 12, 15 billion years ago, an immense explosion that created the universe. And certainly we as Jews accept this notion, and we see the Big Bang as a confirmation of the opening verses of Bereshit. The Big Bang, of course, was really all about energy in its purest form. Light is a form of energy, so God creates on the first day light, which is a great confirmation of the opening chapter verses of Bereshit. Whereas prior to this great discovery in 1967, for which Penzias and Wilson got the Nobel Prize in 1976, the eternity of the universe was the prevailing norm. For 2,000 years, ever since Aristotle, few and far between people questioned the eternity of the universe. Everybody thought the universe was eternal, not at all created among the intelligentsia. Now, however, we could all agree the universe was created. Much more difficult. Hi, Phil. Good to see you. Missed you. More difficult is the second problem, where science asserts universally that the universe is, without question, 12, 15 billion years old. Nobody in the rational scientific world would ever think that the world is 5764. That's an absurdity. It's nonsensical in the scientific world. To solve this problem, we had no choice but to reinterpret Bereshit. A day, if we accept the scientific view of the universe, which I think we have to accept, a day is not equal to 24 hours, rather it's a stage or a phase of creation. The world really is 12.2 billion years old, and yet the Torah uses the word yom, but really means something else. Now, do we have a problem with this? In effect, we are reinterpreting Bereshit. Do we have a problem with reinterpretation? No. The Gemara does not say that regarding days 1, 2, and 3 prior to the creation of the sun. So you agree with that. Nobody would challenge that statement. In addition to which, Ibn Ezra, among other Rishonim, holds day was not 24 hours. So, how you want to deal with the Gemara is one question. There are many sources as we go along, which we will see, which will all agree, the Rambam, Ramban, all agree that Bereshit is not the way it is in our Bereshit. We'll get to that later on. Okay, so hold on to that point for a few minutes. So the question is, do we have a problem with reinterpretation, right? Now, many people do have a problem with reinterpretation. Why? Why are they uncomfortable with reinterpretation? Certainly, you're opening a Pandora's box. You're dealing with a slippery slope. If you're going to start reinterpreting, where's it going to end? Now, of course, that's a nonsensical argument, because one must reinterpret various pesukim from the entire Torah, not the Tanakh, certainly from the Torah as well. Give me an example that we quoted last week where one must reinterpret, where the Torah is not to be meant literally. Yad HaZakah. In numerous occasions, Torah has to be reinterpreted because nobody accepts the notion that God is corporeal or physical. Certainly, there might have been a question during the period of the Rambam, where the Rambam brands anybody that believes that God is corporeal as an absolute pagan, watch out, Hashem Tov, and a heretic in Hagwaba, he's out of the ballpark. And it's very sad because a lot of Jews that I know are actually pagans. Because Haramban Moreh Nevuchim tells you, if you don't have the correct idea of God, you might be a pagan. The question is, what is the correct idea of God? That's Moreh Nevuchim part one. So he's very concerned that Jews have the right idea about what God is. If you believe that God occupies space, you're a pagan. Borei Olam does not occupy space whatsoever. Space is a term that we use regarding objects that are physical. Tell me God occupies space, then you are saying God is physically endowed in one sense or another. Maybe not bodily, but physically in one sense or another, and therefore you are pagan, therefore you're not Chagavah. So, we have to reinterpret all of those metaphors in the Bible which talk about God as physical. Are there a few or many? Tons. God goes up, God goes down, God sees, God has hands. God even speaks is a problem for the Rambam, because how could that which has no mouth actually speak? Rambam's view of prophecy is mental telepathy. He intellectually communicates with the prophet, with the Navi. So Ajaga, on the other hand, says, no, God actually speaks. How does God actually speak? Known as Dibur Nivra. God manipulates the natural forces to bring about a spoken word. Sound waves. So it is. So it's called Dibur Nivra. Okay, either way. So we have no problem reinterpreting all of those statements. No problem. Similarly, I am quite sure here, I'm quite sure everybody here is going to agree with my statement, that when the Torah tells us the statement, Arim Gedolot B'Sod Ad LaShamayim, you're going to reinterpret that because there are no cities that are built to the heavens. So we have to reinterpret that as well. Agreed. Similarly, we're going to reinterpret halakhic statements. Torah tells you, Katutat Kafa, this we did last week, cut off her hand. A woman who touches her husband's adversary below the belt when fighting with her husband, Torah says, Katutat Kafa, Lo Tahus Enecha, don't have compassion. Cut it off. We don't do things like that. Islam does. We Jews don't. Let's reinterpret it. Right? Pshat clearly is cut off her hand. As well as ayin tachat ayin, as well as something as simple as Lord of Shekhidi Bahalevi more. That's not the halacha. Rashbam, of course, makes the point that that is the clear interpretation of it. But it's not the halacha. Rashi sees that the pshat, he differs with Rashbam as to the meaning of that particular statement. Pshat, Rash, etc. Okay, it's not our problem for right now. But those are all things that we have to reinterpret. I would agree with you if you were to challenge and say that if I want to say, which I don't, because we're in Brooklyn, that we want to look at Gan Eden and reinterpret that as well. So I'd agree with you. I don't want to reinterpret Gan Eden. Am I forced to? What are my criteria for reinterpretation? Your slippery slope question and arguing an issue is a problem, no doubt. However, there are many Rishonim who want to reinterpret even Gan Eden. How do we know? Because the Ajah Gaon will tell us that there's no speaking snakes running around. So all of that, we can or cannot necessarily reinterpret. Okay, so that's clear that we have the right to reinterpret something figuratively rather than literally. Right? Wait, Harvey was first, I'm sorry.
Why don't we reinterpret when we're instructed to go to war? It's horrible cutting off the woman's
I made the point last week that we're going to discuss reinterpretation next year. So God willing, we'll be here next year. God willing. Yes, you said it last week also, right. So we don't want to get off our topic now. So we want to talk about reinterpretation and the criteria. As I mentioned to you last week, I guess you didn't do it. Look at Sa'ad Gaon, part 7, chapter 2, chapter 3. We'll give you your criteria for your interpretation, as well as the Rambam, Moreh Nevuchim, part 2, chapter 25. Talks about, you said to say that, as well as many other. The Ramban wants to reinterpret all of Maaseh, all of Bereshit, all the first chapter of Bereshit. It's not as it is. So there are criteria that one must discover as to when one is going to reinterpret anything of Torah. Because that's a legitimate point, without question. In any case, the history of interpretation and reinterpretation has a long and is long and distinguished. So, though we may be somewhat uncomfortable with reinterpreting the word Yom more than 24 hours, but certainly one day is 1, 2, and 3 prior to the sun, no issue. And even Ibn Ezra wants to make that point as well. We have excellent sources that teach us that we have to often reinterpret. What the criteria is another issue. We must reinterpret often the biblical text. Good. So we are not wedded to a literal interpretation of the biblical text. There is nobody in the history of the Jewish tradition, for the aforementioned reasons, that is going to assert absolutely that we take every single word of Torah literally, because of the issues, certainly, of anthropomorphism, or even anthropopathism. Those are issues that one has to reinterpret. Also, Ariyim Gedotzot Ad L'Shamayim, you're not happy with that as well. Yeah.
Are the limits of reinterpretation prescribed in the Gemara itself?
No.
Gemara
is not such an issue.
Say that, well, we could reinterpret, but only as directed by the Gemara.
Gemara does not give us the criteria. That was your first part of your question.
It was reinterpreted, these things, the anthropomorphic things were all mentioned in the Gemara, and that's about it. Anything further than that?
The Rishonim don't agree with that statement. The Rishonim often will question and challenge issues. For example, one of the facts, I don't want to go into this either, to tell you the truth, but an interesting issue is, I always say, I don't want to do a but statement right now. Two interesting examples. One is Hosea Perek Aleph, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Almighty, tells Hosea to go out and find the juiciest, most sleazy woman and marry her. Right? Hosea Perek Aleph. Many men I know would like to hear that prophecy. But God forbid. So now, does Hosea really go out and marry a prostitute and have children, as the text tells us? And when Ezra says no, Gemara says yes to that issue. Similar to other issues like whether or not you're now swallowed by a large fish or not swallowed by a large fish, whether or not, for example, Eliyahu and Elisha revived the dead or not, Rambam's against that. There are many, many issues where the Shonim have different opinions about many things. But this is little opinions. The Rambam, 2:8, Moreinu Bukhim, tells about the seal. About we're not bound by the medicinal opinions of the Talmud. Rabbi Avraham, the Rambam, the Baha'i Gaon, all those Rishonim, said that we're not bound in certain areas. Halachically, we are absolutely bound by the Talmudic statements. That's what Rambam says. But everybody agrees. No Rishon is going to say anything against the halachic formulations of the Talmud. However, in narrative issues, we have much more latitude in many areas. Did the snake really speak in Gan Eden or not? So Ajagun has an issue with that, quoted by Ibn Ezra. So there are many issues like that. So that's that point. Yeah.
But if there is no interpretation,
is what I'm saying?
There is no interpretation of what the Bible says. The less there is, the more fanatic people are in the literal sense of what's written, like cutting.
The more literal you are, the more extreme you are, the more fundamentalist you are.
So
that's correct, right.
You could equate the two, so it's
yes, you can. Yes. The more, it's a legitimate point, absolutely. The rationalists of the medieval period of time, known as some of the Rishonim, the Rambam, the Ramban, all those, would be less, we would not call them fundamentalists or literalists. And that's a good point, but but that is Harvey's point. That's next year's discussion.
Next year's discussion.
Right. We have to get to the body of our text for this evening. Good. So other great rabbis, besides the Rambam, all taught us that we are not wedded to a literal interpretation of, certainly of Maaseh Bereshit, Ramban, as we mentioned, Ibn Ezra, as we mentioned, and others, Malbim as well makes the point, of the modern period of time, have all made the point. Especially with reference to Maaseh Bereshit, the strict literal interpretation of the word Yom, of other areas, is not necessarily the correct interpretation. We are allowed to interpret figuratively, and certainly based on many of the Shonim, we should feel comfortable doing this. However, when we come to the issue of evolution, or the question is how did the animal kingdom develop in general, and how did the human being arise on the scene, is both more difficult and less difficult. That's something we have to really analyze. We've solved the first issue of creation versus eternity simply without issue. We solve the age of the universe through reinterpretation of Maaseh Bereshit, which many of the Shonim agree. And again, those who are uncomfortable, we quoted last time the famous Arya Kaplan statement about this, quoting the Kabbalistic sources, that the Kabbalah as well agrees the universe is 14, 15 billion years old. So he did it through his hermeneutics, his interpretation, however he does it, however the Kabbalah does it. Fine, so the Kabbalah says it, we say it, no issue. The third issue about evolution is much more difficult. Let's first focus on why is the issue of evolution much, much, much less difficult for us to worry about? Gina, answer the question. Right. You're about 3 pages early, but you're on target. We'll get to that in a few minutes. That's from a different page. But you're doing well. Any suggestions? Why is it less difficult for us? The answer is very simple. Because there is less scientific evidence that points to evolution. Or better, there are so many challenges and questions regarding the theory of evolution that you can make a credible argument, as I will later on, that we as Orthodox Jews don't have to worry whatsoever about the issue of evolution. Right? We're going to quote a few scientists and other great intellectuals about evolution itself. Notwithstanding Stephen Jay Gould, I am not going to quote for you a simplistic version of evolution, because that wouldn't be fair. That's what they have in Mutakali Mundu. They quote all the simplistic theories. That was category number 5, if you recall. And then they use that as a straw dummy. What's a straw dummy? You have to know what a straw dummy is. Right. They intentionally set up a straw dummy, and then they set fire to the straw dummy, and that there goes the scarecrow. So one does not want to do that. One wants to be intellectually honest, and one wants to pursue this with all due integrity. Right? So on the one hand, there are so many challenging questions about evolution that we may not have to take it seriously as Orthodox Jews. On the other hand, why is it more difficult of an issue that we face Orthodox Jews? Because once we acknowledge how much evidence there really is in favor of evolution, then we really have to scramble to try to correspond our biblical text with the theory of evolution. So we're going to see how, in fact, that is to be done. Let's briefly first explain the theory of evolution in its simple and complex formulations, then point out some of the flaws and challenges to the theory of evolution, and then come back to the issue of how to respond to it. Let's see. Did I Xerox something for you? I did. I don't know where I put it. Maybe. 1 second. Okay, we didn't do it. Okay, very quickly. Evolution simply says that all the animal kingdom / human being is interrelated. You have much in common with the amoeba. Right? Good. That one species developed or evolved from another, from one simple single-celled amoeba or paramecium, over hundreds of millions of years, we end up having man. How did this change come about? Well, today we know. Genetic mutations. Darwin didn't know that, but we do know that genes simply change. They mutate. And these genetic mutations gave a slight advantage to a particular species, and so it survived. Known as survival of the fittest, or known as well as natural selection. The slight advantage of a longer beak, a longer neck of a giraffe, a wing to fly, all meant survival. That's evolution in its simplest form. Now, certainly it's been criticized. And therefore, we will come to, in a few moments, what's known as punctuated equilibrium, made popular by Goldschmidt, but made famous, more famous, by Stephen Jay Gould. But one can point out that there certainly are flaws with both.
Well,
yeah, please.
What's critical to that evolutionary process is that it's random.
And random. Absolutely random. Correct. We'll get to that in a second. Where I challenge us, I'm going to get to that point in a second. Correct. Now, from Darwin's point of view, there was a continuous flow from one species to another. From that single-celled amoeba, going back 4.5 billion years ago, you end up with a human being. So one can raise the question, does this make sense to anyone? Is it really possible for a single cell to ultimately develop into an organ that is as complex as the eye, and perhaps even more so, one need not say this, as the brain? We made the point that the brain has 1 billion neurons making 1,000 neurological connections, making it an organ with 1 trillion connections, which is more numerous and more complex than the entire railroad system of the United States and probably of the world as well. That's not questionable. The brain is more complex. Now, that little amoeba that's crawling around under Kenny's finger over there, don't smash it. Watch out. That little amoeba became the brain. The body, to any physician, and I've asked many physicians, is a miraculous machine. Spent Saturday night, I had a class, I had a physician, a vascular surgeon. He said, I'm talking about the kidney. The kidney. So I said to him, how many gallons of liquid does the kidney, that flows through the kidney every single day? He said, hundreds, maybe 1,000 gallons of liquid goes through the kidney every single day. Purifying. Sorry?
One person.
That's astounding. That's amazing. Hundreds and hundreds of gallons go through the kidney and are purified by the kidneys. Thank God for that. More complex, or I shouldn't even say that, because who am I to say that, is those of you who are in our synagogue, if you lived in Deal, you would have come to our synagogue in the summer, and Dr. Sharma, Mara Sharma, gave an incredible presentation about the eye, showing how complex the eye really is. Now, the next step is to get a neurologist. Let's tell us about the brain. How complex really is the brain? Well, that would probably be a very short presentation because we don't know all that much about the brain. Right? Correct, exactly. And the body works so that I once heard a lecture about 30 years ago. And in it, the person wanted to raise the question, how much energy would you need to take 1 ton and lift it to the top of the Empire State Building? So he raised the question, everybody's thinking, and all of a sudden he presses on a machine, and the tape recorder goes, boom, boom, boom. What was he referring to?
The heart.
Right. So he figured out that the heart, over the course of a lifetime, has enough energy to take 1 ton, maybe 2 or 3 tons, I don't recall, from ground zero all the way to the top of the Empire State Building, and no time off. It works 24/7. Doesn't stop. Thank God.
But
the stop, you call me CPR.
But the heart is a pump, and the brain is a pump.
Oh, two different organs.
The heart, to the cellular level, there's a beat to it, and they don't know why.
Correct. Oh, well, they don't know why. Absolutely correct. And interestingly enough, the body also, when it breaks down often enough, though sadly not all the time, knows how to fix itself. Isn't that not amazing?
So
when you get old, right? Even that we may someday figure out. So the body is able to fix itself. You can get a cold, now you can take Claritin and feel better, but if you didn't take Claritin, give itself 2 or 3 days and you'll feel better. A week, you feel better. Right? Often enough, the body can fix itself. Now, an evolutionist is going to assert that all of this took place through random chance mutations, an accident. This developed slowly, gradually, over hundreds of millions of years. And of course, Darwin's point in The Ascent of Man that he wrote, that this is true not only of the animal kingdom, it's true of the human being as well. Human beings are as much a result of this chaotic chance as all other species. So now that seems to be ridiculous.
Isn't the mutations because of the environment? Or
no, not necessarily because of environment.
Well, men, when they live in cold places, are short. They have big nostrils.
No, they survived because they were fitter. In other words, there were random mutations, and because those because they were fitter, they survived.
Were they random, or they were adapting to its environment at the moment?
Maybe some interaction between both of those. Both. Now, my incredulity about this whole theory is backed up by legitimate scientific questions. The flaws of evolutionary theory are well known. Give me one. Missing links. Right? Missing links is one. Another, gaps in the fossil record. We cannot really show a clear, linear movement from the beginning to the end.
What's in between that and missing link?
The fossil record is paleontological. It's from paleontologists deal with fossils.
Okay.
Missing links is we deal with people or we deal with species. So one is more behavior, more living. The other one is just simply the fossil record, right? As well, some species show no sign of any kind of change over the course of millions and millions of years. You cannot show a connection between all species. Evolution says that it all went from one cell to us that have trillions of cells. You can't show that between species. In the animal kingdom as well, you can't show that. And
evolution of animals,
of everything. I'm sorry, what? I'm talking about evolution of everything. The what?
In the bones. Can they try
to... No, in anything. No. In nothing can we. Now, the odds are astronomical of all of this working. Now, I will quote for you Rabbi Avigdor Miller. Although he's category number 5, as discussed last week, and therefore you can't really trust what he has to say because he's only going to give you partial evidence, he does make an interesting point over here. He said, take a booklet of 15 loose pages, right? 15 pages. Throw them up. They all land on your table. After shuffling the sheets, what are the odds that these 15 shuffled sheets will ending up from 1 to 15? I'd like a little bit better than that. He did the math, but you can't trust everybody. Correct. Good. It's, you're close. 1 in 1,370,700,000,000. Yeah, we know, but that is again, it's a big deal. So I don't know how far you take that. Rejoice Our Youth, page 10. Imagine if the book had 100 pages. You throw it all up and flies all over the place, and is it going to land 1 to 100? The chances are a billion times a billion times a billion is what he says. Good. That would be equivalent for a cell to develop, he says, into the leg of an ant, which has 100 different variables. And think about what the odds are if all this were to work for a cell to develop into a brain. You have to be a fool to even think so, one would think. Further, Rabbi Miller argues that the subhumans from which man has quote-unquote developed have never been found. That is, he says, you haven't found any men, quote-unquote, with tails, horns, or wings. So if man developed from an earlier species, Rabbi Miller says, we should find some kind of record of that. We have no record like that. We have Neanderthal, but he's really human. If we want to find pre-Neanderthal...
Well, there's the ape. The question is where the ape comes from. That's where we stop.
Okay, correct. And the question also is, why did the ape stop over there and not develop into a human being? One of the good questions. Correct, yeah. So, how could there be no evidence of that missing link of a human being with a tail? Because he developed from something with a tail, or horns, or with a tail. Good. Even the new arguments of the neo-Darwins, such as Goldschmidt and Stephen Jay Gould, alayhi shalom, does not, of course, solve the problem, because punctuated equilibrium, which means that, yes, you're right, there is no gradual transition from species to species, but what they've seen is that there are sudden leaps, explosions, if you will, in the mutation record. So therefore, though, of course you can't find missing links, because we went from this point all the way to this point.
So is that giving birth to a lion?
We haven't seen that. That's a question even on him. Yes. Right. Yeah, but we haven't seen that either. So we don't have that either. So there are still many questions that one can raise on all these issues. We don't see species changing, etc. So the odds question is still out there. All these are legitimate questions.
I'm sorry. What's the evolutionist
Neo. The Neo? The Neo?
The evolutionist backup. What's their explanation for these huge leaps?
Nothing. That's just what the record is showing. It's another theory. There's no proof of it. It's only another theory.
Let's say we were to subscribe to their theory of evolution.
Panda's thumb.
We haven't found it yet.
We have a panda's thumb. Stephen Jay Gould's book on panda's thumb describes how the functionality of the panda and its thumb, what it's good for. And in that book, he tries to argue for this new theory of punctuated equilibrium, where all of a sudden you have a new creation. Okay, let's leave that alone. Yes, you have many, many questions that one can raise. Still, the astronomical odds are incredible. Now, but for all that Rabbi Miller says, one has to challenge, because his science is poor, it's relied on tertiary sources, and because he's not interested in truth per se, he's only interested in proving religion, which is what Harambam, as we mentioned last week, in Moreh B'chi, Part 1, Chapter 71, is very much against. Mutakalimun, that's who they are. So he does a great job proving religion, but you have to really, you don't really, can't really trust anything that he says. So I wasn't happy only, yes, I'm sorry, David. No, okay. I want to drink.
To answer that argument, the work of Fred Hoyle,
yes, Fred Hoyle, good friend of David's. He has good teeth? Does he have good teeth? Fred Hoyle?
So far.
Good. Okay, good. So, reading with Joshua Youth is a game that religionists or theists play when they really don't want to know the truth. They really want to know the truth, they have to go and get the best evidence for all these issues. Right? That's obviously what you want to do. About 25 years ago, as a sophomore at YU, I read a book called The Inescapable Truth by a guy named Gottlieb. Why do you remember a book that you read 25 years ago by Gottlieb? Because anytime you can find inescapable truth, you know that's a silly book. So what did he do? He quotes Aristotle, he quotes every single person you could imagine. He never read Aristotle. For sure he never read Aristotle. He just found a book of quotes and used that to prove whatever he wanted to prove, about God being God. He says, Aristotle believes in God. And that's a stupid statement, because Aristotle does not believe in the God that you and I believe in. What is Aristotle's view of God? Primal one is not good enough. He is the primal, but it's not good enough. For Aristotle, God is. What is the highest activity a human being can do? Thinking. So therefore, God must be thought, thinking about what's the highest object in the universe? Thought, God himself. So God is only self-reflecting on himself. Thought, thinking, thought. So nothing to do with us. So to quote Aristotle as a believer in God is silly. And so on throughout the entire book, what does this quote? These great thinkers that say they all believe in the God of, you know, of Judaism. So it's a silly book. He doesn't really care about truth, he cares about proving religion. So we don't want to do it, we want truth. So we tried to find other sources that really, in fact, question evolution. Right? Dr. W. M. Thorpe came out strongly in 1965 against the randomness of mutation. Says there are all kinds of issues, problems, with the notion of animal species change. He says, I quote, the most basic biological performances and structural elements of simple organisms and the complex life forms have remained unaltered in their basic forms for thousands of years, unquote. Professor Ernest Chain, Nobel Prize winner, says, to postulate that the development and survival of the fittest is entirely a consequence of chance mutations seems to me a hypothesis based on no evidence and irreconcilable with the facts. These classical evolutionary theories are a gross oversimplification of an immensely complex and intricate mass of facts, and it amazes me that they are swallowed so uncritically and readily and for such a long time by so many scientists without a murmur of protest. Right? Furthermore, strikingly, Dr. Harold Urey, who is a Nobel Prize winner as well, good scientist, who says, chemist, quote, all of us who study the origin of life find that the more we look into it, the more we feel that it's too complex to have evolved anywhere. But we believe as an article of faith that life evolved from dead matter on this planet. It's just that its complexity is so great that it's hard for us to imagine that it did. Similarly, Dr. Fred Hoyle, yes, David?
Yes.
Tells us that the fossil record is highly imperfect, not because of the inadequacies of geology, but because the slow evolutionary connections required by the theory did not happen, period. And finally, even Newsweek 1982, after publishing an article on the latest version of the evolutionary theory, punctuated equilibrium, tells us, quote, through all the excitement it has generated, punctuated equilibrium still smacks of heresy to many scientists, does not explain what many regard as the crucial point, how and why a new species springs. Right? So all of these scientists, Nobel Prizes among them, challenge evolution. If we were to stop here, we can go home a little bit earlier to have dinner and be very happy, but intellectually dishonest. On the other hand, despite all of the questions and challenges, there is just too much evidence for us to ignore. Thousands of observations and experiments do show that there is certainly genetic mutations and that there is certain kind of change between species. Darwin was no fool. First of all, he was a religious man. He was a believer in the church before it excommunicated him. He was a believer and he was a religious man, and he didn't want or expect to find this. It was an accident. He's traveling, as I mentioned last week, his 5 years on His Majesty's ship, the Beagle, and he just saw what he saw. He observed and he speculated. Why are we so upset at him? And there is clear change between species. We, of course, share 99% of the same genetic matter as all living organisms. Furthermore, if God did create a human being, He created him not very different, chemically and genetically, from other species. And if He did create the panda's thumb, as Gould argues, He did it very inelegantly. There's much that one could speak about and challenge and question. If God did create all of this, and it wasn't simply random, but it's all divinely done, why is it so messy? It is messy. Many animals are messy. God, Gould argues, could have done a better job in this and the panda and other species as well. So now, it would not be an exaggeration to say, despite its problems, and there are many, more so than I've quoted, and despite these few scientists that have challenged the evolutionary theory, still in all, evolution is the best theory we have that accounts for most of the evidence that we observe. I tried to find on the internet, and I believe I found, but I didn't check it again, I should have, this was last week, that 98% of biologists and paleontologists do believe in some form of evolution, as well as 40% of those who do believe in it believed in a God that did in fact use evolution in order to bring about that which we have. Of course, nobody could explain why God used evolution to bring about what we have. Any suggestions? Yeah?
God has to stick to a system. Whatever it was that God created in the beginning of the Big Bang, whatever rules nature was
okay.
Set upon, evidently evolution was the way it happened.
But he created nature.
Yeah, whatever.
Could he have created a better nature?
Well, he could have, but let's not go. That would be back to the Big Bang question. Whatever reason he made.
No, Big Bang. I understand why God created the Big Bang because He wanted us.
No, I'm saying what happened in the Big Bang happened. Gravity
say you,
happened.
Us.
Yeah, gravity.
Ezra
happened.
And I.
Gravity, random mutations, whatever it is, there's the theory of everything, some rule that's being repeated throughout the universe that's causing everything to happen. So evidently, in accordance with that rule, maybe evolution had to happen. God's not going to break His own system, and this just happens to be the system He set up, so evolution works with it.
So the question is, why did this happen to be the system that He set up? So really, but anyway, we agree it's messy, it's inelegant.
What do you say messy?
It's inefficient. It's inefficient.
What's messy? What's doing?
99% of species are extinct. You think it's organized?
What is
all genetic mutations are in a bad direction? very infrequent for genetic mutation to lead to a
to work. And even, yeah, correct. Yeah, so that's inelegant.
That's the vast minority lead to positive.
So we agree.
But God made rules. He has to stick to the rules. He's not going to make it better than
the next.
Yeah,
I agree. He has to protect the rules. But why create rules that we stick to? Don't go away.
Why are those the rules?
Yeah, why are those the rules? We don't know. The answer is that if we knew we'd be, if we knew we'd be God, we'd understand why. So, keep things fun. That's a good example. My answer to this is Moreno Bochim, part 3, chapter 13. I believe that's the correct reference. Look it up. Yeah. Good pedagogue. Look it up. That's my answer to this. Contrary to Sajigo and Emor Bede'ot, part 2, Ma'amar Sheni. Contrary to that, those two, Sajigo and Rambam, argue vehemently about this issue. And I think the Rambam is correct. Part 3, chapter 13 of Moreh de Bochim.
Don't we
have one here? Use the original Arabic to get the straight story. Because I had to do. Okay, so now, if you have 98% of scientists believe in evolution, they're no fools. So the question is...
It doesn't make sense.
Sorry?
But they're saying it doesn't make sense.
No, they're saying there are issues that we haven't yet solved. Now, there's more to it that meets the eye. Keep on thinking, keep on searching. We only have half the pie at this point. There's more to think about. And it does solve a lot of problems. It does explain phenomena we have. And it does work in thousands of observations.
The problem is that today, the way evolution is thought, it's intermixed with genetics.
Well,
it's just assumed to be genetics equals evolution, and that's not necessarily...
Correct. Sure.
The biggest problem with evolution is the timeline that we perceive. The timeline that we men have been thinking about,
okay, good,
compared to the length that it's been happening is so vast that I don't think we have the understanding of really what time over...
Okay, good. Let's look at that point for a second.
Okay.
Since you raised it. I was going to get to it later, but here is a timeline by an Orthodox Jewish scientist. This really comes in later, but since we're talking about it now, look at it now just for a minute. Timeline. Thank you. This is from Biblical Science, Biblical Creation and Science, Nathan Abiezer. He's a PhD from the University of Chicago. He's written hundreds of scientific articles. He's well known in the field of physics. He has two timelines. Appendix B, share them please, gives you a notion as to what we're talking about. Archaeological time scale listing the cultural ages and the hominid species belonging to the genus Homo. The time scale has been expanded for recent times. You have Neolithic, which is 10,000 years ago, which is modern man. 40,000 years ago, you have Neanderthal man. Come back to this later on. Paleolithic. And you have 100,000 years ago, 300,000 years ago, Homo erectus, which again is man in some sense or other, and so on. The question you have to raise is, where is Selem Elokim over here? Gina? That's the question. Wait, where is Selem Elokim over here? That's the question we want to raise, right? We're going to come to this in a few moments.
Well, it would be the leap from an animal to a thinking man.
Correct. So the leap from Neanderthal, who looks like a human being and buries his dead and does a lot of things that human beings do 40,000 years ago, he's not yet Selem Elokim. We're going to call Selem Elokim that human being that calls out to God. Now we have a verse to that, for that. What's our verse? Az hochal lekro b'shem Hashem. Right? That's talking about Enosh. What's Enosh? What equivalent, what Enosh means what? Human
man.
Being, first, man, good. So now, is that an accident? What does that all mean? It's an interesting question as to who Enosh really was, what does that pasuk really mean? It's a machloka dishonim, as to halakro b'shem Hashem. Then they began to call out in the name of God, is the pshat, seems to be, of the pasuk. So, let's assume that we could now think about, based on this question, that there was an Adam prior, and he achieved a certain stage of human development, which we will call Selem Elokim. And then there's a further development of Enosh, for people then to call out in God's name. and then we could evolve to greater and more intense spirituality till we reach, let's say, Moshe Rabbeinu.
What about Adam?
He's prior. He's prior.
He also called out to God. God called out to him.
God called out to him.
But they had a conversation.
In a certain sense. It could be different levels of conversation. The Zohar that you're going to read when you have a son, God willing, soon, get married first, but we'll talk about that exact point. What level does God speak to Abraham before the Brit Milah and after the Brit Milah? One is B'mahazeh, and if it was in a higher level. So traditional Jewish thinking will tell you that God speaks to you on different levels. So however we want to understand the Gan Eden conversation, remember, after Gan Eden, there's no conversation between man and God whatsoever. It ends in Gan Eden. So whatever the conversation was all about is one story. Then we might see a different development after Gan Eden, which might be either Enosh, a new recreation, or a new discussion, or whatever it may be.
Did he have a discussion with the monkeys?
No. Because prior to that, well, this has to be viewed as part, as almost a tree-like. The monkeys and human beings may have come from the same tree, but they're different branches.
Right.
Right? That would be part of the new modern variation.
Why is one branch better than
the other? Not better. Because man called out to God, let's say after God Ayadin, because God might be a separate theological encounter. Right? There are different times when God Sinevo Ed Vaesh or Har Sinai, those are separate theological encounters. But once you have post Gan Eden, so now you have when man calls out to God. So then God responds. Let's hold on to that because we'll come back to in a few minutes, okay? So what I'm getting at over here is that this would.
Rabbi, when's the Enosh after Noah?
Before.
I don't know if I find that theory. The
which theory are you talking about?
The monkey is the past before.
Agreed. He's a different branch. I agree. Yeah, I agree.
There's a different question also.
Yeah, absolutely.
They always spoke
to
him.
To Enosh. No. I didn't say that. No. No, not at all. No. No, not at all. Not at all.
They may not have had the faculties either.
Agreed. Yeah, they only looked like human beings.
Right.
They were Homo erectus. They stood up tall. Standing up. No, not necessarily. No, I raise it as a question. We have to now try to fit in. We have to try to fit in where those Pesukim Bereshit fit into this overall scheme.
Well, it was proven that modern man and Neanderthal man lived at the same time.
Well,
the evolution theory of the Neanderthal man becoming the modern man, it's really no longer an issue. The question is, why did the Neanderthal man
die out,
got extinct? Well, they said it was intermarriage.
With Ashkenazim or
with the modern man.
Oh, okay.
But now they have found the modern man has been around as
long. That's what he's saying. Okay, I'll get to what he's saying. Okay. So let's leave this on the side for a minute. This is still going to give you a basic broad calendar. But I want to get back and come back to this in a few minutes. So we're not going to leave this alone. So we seem to have many scientists. He's one of them. Here's another. Right? And I have one more book in the car, which I forgot to bring, by Judah Lander, who I think is the best book possibly, all of whom grapple with this question of who is Adam, who is Tzelem Elohim, how are we going to put all this together? Right? For some reason, in the late 90s, or I guess early 90s, it became an issue for Orthodox Jews to try and solve all these problems. Right? So now, Gerald Schroeder, very famous book, PhD, MIT, legitimate scientist, well-known Orthodox Jew, who deals with these issues. Same with Aviezer, and same with Lander, Judah Lander. They all have impeccable scientific credentials. I don't think they understand biblical interpretation quite as well as they should. They're not PhDs in biblical interpretation. So I think that's the lacking of these books. Nevertheless, legitimate books. I think Schroeder is better than Aviezer. And I think Lander is better than Schroeder, but all add something interesting to the discussion. Now, these are scientists who believe in evolution, who came to the issue out of what one would say a legitimate intellectual confusion. How do I work it out that Bereshit corresponds to the Big Bang? I know the Big Bang, I know Bereshit, how's that going to work out? These are the questions that every thinking Jew is going to ask. So now, we have to raise the question, how does an Orthodox Jew respond to the issue of evolution? Is it compatible with Torah or not? So whereas we agreed and said before that evolution is the development, what does Bereshit teach us about the animal kingdom? Is it static or evolving? Seems to be the Bereshit. Static. God said, and it was. Right? That's what it seems to be, superficially.
No, because there is a systematic order. He doesn't create the animal.
I'm getting to it. Getting to it. Hold on. So it seems to be static. But is it really so? Now, again, we have mentioned that there are the rejectionists. The rejectionists, such as Rabbi Miller, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, whose article on Sanchez I found incredibly naive, I mean to the point of being silly. And I read it 25 years ago, and I reread it saying it can't be as silly as what it was, and it was. It's naive. He knows better. Maybe he doesn't know. He's an engineer. He's trained as an engineer from the Sorbonne, so that doesn't mean you know biology. So I found it incredibly naive about his understanding of science, with all due respect. And certainly, though the rejectionists, those people who don't see any validity to the scientific endeavor, as Rabbi Miller, as Rabbi Cherebli, and others, we would like to argue that Torah really is compatible with evolution, where we are of category neither rejectionist, as they are, nor of the isolationists, as Rabbi Tendler might be. Rabbi Tendler is a PhD in biology. He knows his stuff. But I would call him an isolationist. What does isolation mean that we discussed? That they maintain both science and Torah, and they don't try to integrate it.
Compartmentalize.
That's the word. Very good, so thank you for coming.
Compartmentalize.
They hold them just two different worlds that never the twain shall meet. Sorry? No, never. Absolutely not. Terrible statement. He's an integrationist. The Rambam is an integrationist. The Rambam is an integrationist. We all agree. One second. No, he's an isolationist. No, he's probably a rejectionist. That's Sheba, that's just for Northern France. But the Ramban is an integrationist of level two, because he's less bold than the Rambam. Rambam went into it and swam those streams with an incredible fervor, I would say. As Moreh Nevuchim indicates, the whole Moreh Nevuchim is about guarding us through those problems of science and religion. The whole Moreh Nevuchim, reinterpreting every which way that you have to, right? Ramban is much more cautious, and in the aftermath, it's true that he should be more cautious. I mean, at the end, the Ramban was wrong about Aristotelian science, right? The Ramban never went full heart into it, though his opening comment on Bereshit does speak about Greek science and that everything was created from Yuli. What is Yuli? Who knows Greek? David.
Yuli is like total.
Yeah, that's what is it in Greek? Hylic matter. Aristotle will tell you that everything is eternal. But eternal is all developed from hylic matter. So the Ramban is an Aristotelian in that sense. He tries to integrate Bereshit with Aristotle's notion of hylic matter. Ralbad, on the other hand, is a superior integrationist in saying that there's no such thing as creation. It was all an eternal universe. Harambam Renevuchim, in his chapter on creation, talks about the Midrash, which says God created all out of the snow by the Kisei HaKavod, which the Rambam says we reject that, but that's Plato's understanding that God created everything from eternal matter. But the Ramban accepts eternal matter. So Ramban is an integrationist, but more cautious than the Ramban. Okay, let's go on. So now, even though we have rejectionists, and we have isolationists, we really have real integrationists. But there's a very huge however over here. Right? The question, and the real question is, how big of a however are you comfortable with in analyzing the question? Now let's analyze. Torah does, of course, show some form of evolutionary development within its own system, right? Third day, you have trees and vegetation. Fifth day, you have marine animals, birds. Sixth day, you have mammals, culminating with man. In broad outline, certainly, this is compatible with scientific evolution. Right?
It's not dependent on the thing before it. It's separate things. Evolution implies
it doesn't tell you why.
It's a broad outline. Broad outline.
Yeah, what about the fourth day?
Agreed, I got problems. I agree with you. I said broad outline. Give me a break. I got to go back to deal tonight. Broad its outline. Good. But we can also note, one second, that one can see in this broader or broadest outline Aviezer's formulation great stuff over here. It's worth reading, though it's not perfect. Aviezer. Not perfect, but there's some good stuff. He tries to really coordinate. I just want to get to his chart of how everything worked out.
Can you read the Schroeder...
Sure, second, next book, no.
The number...
Oh, he does that in this book. He looks at the numbers, how it all works out.
The relative quantum.
Yes. I'm not happy with it. Because I don't think it's a good biblical exegete. In any case, Aviezer also has a broad outline of how this works out. We'll find it later. But in broad outline, third day, fifth day, sixth day, this certainly could fit into the Torah's view. Especially in the light of the verse, Totze Ha'atz Nefesh Hayah. That's a great verse. What does it mean? Totze Ha'atz Nefesh Hayah. What does it mean? The earth should bring forth life. At some point, this verse seems to indicate that all life comes from Ha'aretz, from a single source, even you may want to argue, one second please, from inorganic matter. That's one of the great questions. What created life? So life comes from what? You all know this elementarily. Where did life come from? Well, you had, let's say, some carbon atoms, right? And carbon is not fused together to create nucleotides, which ended up as amino acids, which ended up as, ultimately, organic chemistry tells you, proteins, good, and you have life. But it came from carbon, as it all began, right? And Schroeder has this great statement, as you'll see in a minute, which shows how chemically and genetically we are alike to the ground. To the ground. One second. So, when you have over here this notion that Schroeder mentions, what do we call man? Adam. What do we call ground? Adama. Hebrew. Adama. So, Schroeder wants to say, in this nice formulation, saying that look how amazing, how similar Adam is to Adama, how we are so close from one to the other, from chemically and genetically. Right? Is Schroeder's point. So we could see in very broad outlines how these issues do correspond. Maseches Chulin, Daf Kaf Zayin tells us that life came from a swamp-like interface between earth and water. Right? Interesting. If you remember, going back to earliest, CH4 is methane gas. CH4 methane gas within the medium of water H2O, with lightning or electricity or energy, could create the first molecules that may ultimately, that's how life came about. So Schroeder, based on this, page 135, maintains that the chemical and genetic makeup of the human being is so closely connected to the earth that it's amazing that the Torah saw Adam to Adama as appropriate. And he further makes the point on page 150, we'll come back to this later on. In a certain sense, he says, everything is made of... Better.
Dust.
What kind of dust? Stardust. Are we not all made from stardust? That's scientifically true. Atoms, cells, molecules, Tzai teaches this as Bereshit. Furthermore, the Ramban makes the point on Pasuk Aleph, Kafav of Perek Aleph, Na'ase Adam. I Midrash as well. What is Na'ase Adam? What's the problem with that word? Na'ase Adam is plural. And should not be said if God is not plural, right? So then, what's Ramban's answer? From Elyonim and Tachtonim. From the divine spirit along with the Tachtonim, meaning ground. Sorry? That's world wheat, Sajigon's explanation. Sajigon says that, as others say that. Ramban says no, not in the plural, because God created mankind from the above and the below, as Bereshit Perek Bet tells you. Right? Bereshit Adam, Afar Min Adamah, God fashions mankind from the ground, and then he brings in the divine spirit. The question is, when did that happen over here? Right? Good. So the Ramban tells us, the land brought forth and God infused his distinctive quote-unquote, Gina, Tzelem Elokim, into the person, into his nostrils, as, hence the human being. That is, therefore, the human being was physically similar to what preceded him and yet spiritually distinct. Right? Bereshit, science, comes very close together. So then one can easily see the six stages of creation, if one chooses to, as day one, light, water, earth, two, three, fish, fowl, four, insects, animals in paleolithic age, five, the post-paleolithic age of mammals, and finally man, six stages. So Eliezer will say on page 72 that we go to great lengths, we can go to great lengths to match these two systems, right? And it's all done very elegantly. In that fashion. Right? All these correspondence should not be underestimated. Right? But, now we're coming to our huge however. What is problematic about Eliezer's book is that to get to the correspondence that he wants to, he must engage in what I call creative exegesis. He has to reinterpret so far so that have we not fallen off the appropriate spectrum of proper biblical interpretation? How far do you want to go? He's able to talk about a great massive flood, which no geologist would talk about 5,000 years ago. But it did happen 300 million years ago. So that's the flood of Bereshit, he says. Does that work? Why doesn't it work? Because 300 million years ago, there were no people, right? Exactly. 300,000 years ago. So in the age of God, it's great, so it doesn't work. And ultimately, it's creative, it just does not really work. So I'm bothered by that. Schroeder is a little bit better, I think, from that point of view. Now, two more minutes. One can easily find enough biblical, Talmudic, and philosophical sources that provide us with enough justification for accepting the evolutionary hypothesis. You should not be bothered by this. It should not bother you whatsoever. But to do so, are we not doing some damage to the appropriate interpretation of the biblical text? As mentioned, in broad outline, Torah does correspond. Good. Are we concerned, or how concerned should we be about deviating from the literal interpretation and utilizing a figurative interpretation? You have a number of options over here. One, you might say, don't be so concerned because Torah itself is often in need of figurative interpretation. You apply it to evolution, to Bereshit, same thing. Don't be concerned about it. You might as well quote all the Rishonim who push us to interpret Maaseh Bereshit specifically, figuratively. Sa'adja Gaon, Ibn Ezra, Ramban are all opening up all of these doors for us. Certainly with regard to Shishimei Bereshit. As does the Malbim among the moderns. The Malbim is a well-regarded who says, quote, there is no inconsistency between the modern concept of animal species development and the Torah itself. So if he says so, why are we so upset about what anybody else says? All of that works very nicely. And certainly, the Rambam's mode of biblical interpretation that we've discussed on other occasions in 225 from Moreh Nevuchim tells us that we have an obligation of reinterpreting when science proves something to be incompatible with the literal interpretation of the Torah itself. That's the Rambam. If science proves evolution, then you have an obligation, because you pursue truth, your obligation is to reinterpret. As we did with anthropomorphisms. God as viewed as physical. Right? So we have a lot of options over here. So certainly evolution should not at all be a disturbance to anybody's theology. It's hard for me to understand why the right wing of the, let's say, of the Lakewood crowd, or of Rabbi Miller, or of Lubavitch Rebbe, why they're so defensive when our sources are so able to deal with this particular conflict. A, evolution is not so serious. It has a lot of issues. B, if you take it seriously and you say that it's really true, which I would feel comfortable with, we have tons of sources that are, and I haven't only gone to touch I've only touched the surface over here. There's so many more sources, Talmudic, Midrashic, Baramot Machaliban, in the period of the Rishonim, that open us to all kinds of possibilities, all kinds of options. Don't worry about this. And in a last case scenario, if I really was stuck, and this is really where it counts, in an issue, let's say, of biblical criticism, that's what you have to worry about. That's something very serious. This is not serious at all to anybody who's straight thinking, who knows the sources. Biblical criticism, you're really going to push the envelope. And when you do in that fashion, we have to really get a life jacket. Biblical criticism is the issue that one has to worry about, not evolution, not the age of the earth whatsoever. We always, in that context, we have much less sources that will solve our problem. They're going to have to rely exclusively on the Rambam, who teaches us to reinterpret when science / truth demands it. Haramban makes his very famous comment in Shemarat Kedakim, in his book on the 8 chapters, Shemaim Mishamara. That should be your guiding principle throughout life. Certainly when it comes in conflict with science or anything else. What does it mean? Follow truth from whatever its source. If the source is science, you follow truth. If the source is psychology, you follow truth. If the source is biblical criticism, if it's truth, you have to follow it and then, therefore, reinterpret.
That's making the Bible bulletproof, right?
In that sense, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, good.
Then you got to
correct.
Reinterpret.
Reinterpret. But therefore, what that really means, what you said is correct, I think, is that the Torah really is the source of our values. Torah is in need of commentary, which from the very beginning we know. We would not reinterpret, however, let's say the commandment, Lo Tirzah, do not murder, do not steal, do not commit adultery. There are certain moral principles that we would not be willing to reinterpret.
But sometimes killing is okay.
Yeah, that's not murdering.
All right.
That's different.
You do not steal for kidnapping, not stealing.
Yes, two different pesukim. Two different pesukim, whatever it may be. Correct, two different pesukim. So now, those moral values, Tzelem Elohim, Tikkun Olam, those are absolute. Nobody would want to say that a human being is not Tzelem Elohim. I have a right to kill you because you're not Tzelem Elohim. You're really an ape. So nobody would say that. So one should think about those bottom line principles where one does not have a right to reinterpret. That's a good, legitimate question. But certainly when we talk about issues, as we've been talking about, those one can very easily see science as revealing that which is in Torah. Torah is compatible. It works. So therefore, it should not disturb anybody. Furthermore, the Gemara Masechet Yoma, which it also should be your guiding light, which makes the statement, God's seal is truth. You want to pursue truth. Whatever truth may be in the scientific realm, or in the psychological realm, or in any realm, whatever is truth, that's the absolute principle of which you want to live. However, you cannot tell me that the Nazi truth is truth, one would be very cautious if one were told by a person who comes speaking the name of God, who said, God told me that you have a right to kill black people. Just kill them. Genocide. Kill all black people. Or you have a right to kill all Down syndrome children. Right? We have a right to kill them, as the Nazi said. They're subhuman. They have a right to kill them. So if anybody said that to you, you'd have to challenge that. And in fact, Torah does help us with that. The rabbis help us with that. And says that anybody who proclaims himself to be a civilized human being by safeguarding what? More?
Morality.
Seven Noahide principles, morality. Seven Noahide principles. They believe in those principles, even if they may come from Amalek / Nazi, you have no right to touch them. Right to the contrary, you must support them and love them and heal them and visit them when they're sick and bury them when they die. Every human being that believes in these seven Noahide principles has absolute rights in Torah tradition and is guaranteed a portion of the world to come. The only religion in the history of the world that says that. That you're not part of my religion, but you have a right to the world to come, the absolute ultimate eternal reward, if you believe in seven Noahide commandments. Don't kill, don't steal, commit. Those are the basic bottom line principles that we believe in. So nobody can come along and uproot those seven Noahide principles. Don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery. Don't be cruel to animals. Don't curse God. Don't believe in idols. And be a just person. Justice and righteousness. Batei din. Justice. You live in those seven. You're into the world to come. You cannot be harmed by a Jew. You are, without question, viewed as Helek Olam Hava, a portion of the world to come. Equal, I would say, to the Jewish person. So, we have here a very thin line. But one has to respect the thin line between pursuing truth as an absolute, between interpreting Torah when we see it contradicting truth, and maintaining our values as absolute. That's the critical variable. The values that must be maintained as absolute are the ones that you want to see as holy. Is the 7 days of Bereshit holy that I cannot reinterpret? None of the Rishonim say so, or the ones that we quoted did not say so. Any questions? Ricky, you have some questions?
You said it also wonderfully.
Midivar sheket et hak.
Last week you said something about how it would work out if you... Actually, not so relevant.
I want to hear.
No.
I have an irrelevant question.
Irrelevant.
Very.
I like irrelevant questions.
Is there any relationship between the golem being created from dirt and man being created from dirt?
Do you believe the golem was actually created?
I don't know.
15th century, Arnold Franz?
It was not. How do you know?
Because the myth of the golem actually was something which started 100 years after Maharam of Prague lived. So he had nothing. It's a complete myth.
You just made it up?
No, it was an interesting story. Probably related to the Frankenstein.
But it doesn't even matter. But the point is,
I'm going to send you an article. I'll tell you the whole story by an academician from Chaim Berlin, no less. So he will tell you why
but
it's not
fact
true.
That it was created from dirt. Is it any relationship to what?
Genesis chapter 2 tells you that God made mankind from dirt and then breathed in him. So the same idea. David.
You want me to read the Rambam since the word God would use evolution?
I'll never get home.
Well, it just says simply that he wanted that one.
Right. The issue over here is the pasuk in Mishlei. Read the pasuk in Mishlei that he opens the chapter with. The ma'aneh is the key word. God created everything not for the sake of the human being, but rather for God's own creative energies. It's just God creates.
The Lord had made everything.
Le Mishlei, what chapter? Mishlei.
Proverbs 16.
Mishlei. Thank you. Mishlei.
16:4,
right, you know that. 16:4, right. So that's the key verse for the Rambam, that God created everything not for the sake of the human being, which is what Sa'aja says, but rather for the sake of God. God doesn't answer to the human being. And I want to make one last point. Bill, please, you first, then I'm by this point.
Okay.
Can't we say that Aristotle believed in God, except that
he did.
He called him the prime mover, right?
Yes, he believed in God. Absolutely believed in God.
He did believe in God.
Everybody tells him believes in God.
Okay.
He was a bright guy, he believed. Yes, absolutely. Correct.
So what do you think this is the only planet that God...
I don't think this is the only planet that has life on it.
That God gave life expecting...
I don't agree. I think there are many.
Oh, okay.
I think there are many. You have, in this galaxy, a billion stars. Of some of those, you have... And you have another 100 million galaxies. You have 100 billion trillion stars. Around some of those stars, there are planets. And it may very well be life of some other form, or the same form, someplace else.
But with intelligence.
Yeah, I would not limit God's creative potential.
Right.
Why should one do so? Sorry?
What? I've been reading Time magazine, we may have proof in a few years, Mars.
It won't be a Mars. It can't be Mars. Yeah, that'd be very boring.
If they find water, they will find.
I don't know if it's going to be a Mars or wherever it may be. Yes, it's possible. Yeah. Absolutely. No, I don't know. I don't know. I would not be surprised to find a cousin. Looks like me. That's two heads, probably right. One should think, and one should raise the question. I'll leave you with this point. I'm going to give this out for you to read at home. One, I don't know why one would think that we are the end of the evolutionary chain. I'm not sure why one would think this.
Or the beginning.
We may be the beginning, as I'm saying.
I'm not so sure.
In other words...
Well, that's why there's all that happened, for the next evolutionary...
Possibly. In other words, Borei Olam, God is involved in this experiment that involves human beings, and maybe the ultimate evolution is us to become more God-like. In my Maimonidean context, that would be more intellectual. Your mind developed. Maybe more spiritual. And for the Rambam, the Navi, let's say, is somebody who's intellectually perfect and morally perfect. So that's another stage, so to speak, in how we should develop and go beyond. Why would we limit God to us? I think it would be an absurdity. It involves our conception of what and who God is. So one should not think that we're necessarily the end of the evolutionary development. We simply are another stage that's going to develop into more intellectual, more spiritual beings. David. One second. David.
That seems to me, just on the surface, that it's very outside the circle of normative Judaism.
I don't know that normative Judaism deals with that issue.
Well, I think that normative Judaism at least gives us the sense that we are...
Mashiach,
redemption,
whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I'd go a step beyond. You might be right. Judaism is a very this-worldly religion, and therefore normative Judaism would deal with us as we are. That makes perfect sense to me.
But to answer your question, like, why would we think that?
Right, correct, I agree.
I think that's what we've grown up with.
Yeah, but I'm just throwing this out. I don't necessarily know that I believe it. I'm throwing it out, and I've thought about it. Are we the end product? I think God wants us to perfect ourselves beyond what we are.
If there's creation, if we want to believe in creation in time, then we almost have to believe that. Because why did God create us at this time, the universe at this time, when He's infinite and He's eternal?
He could have created
us at any time. So therefore, there has to have been other worlds before us. And there will probably be other worlds after us, if you think.
Other worlds might, other worlds, Harivan, which is the famous Rashic statement, Bishitaba, that God is ongoingly creating in other parts, in other places, in other times, and it's all developing. Everything is movement. Who said that?
The last one you worked on, they blew themselves.
Heraclitus. That might have happened as well. No, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
They have to start again.
Yeah. Heraclitus. Question? No.
What you asked, why would we limit God's potential creativity? It's our ego. Our ego.
Not mine. I'm from New Jersey.
I'm saying
Brooklyn. Mine.
People in general.
It's only humanity.
Because their ego don't want to.
That might be, but I don't. You're right. I mean, that. Okay, I'm going to end now, and I'm going to give out just one page that I was going to read, but it's really kind of like a rough summary of all that we said from Schroeder's book, right? So it's a one page, and I thought it includes a lot of the important points. Just to summarize what we were talking about, and you may take one and read it or not read it. I want to thank everybody for coming. I appreciate it.
Quick question. The Ravid was a strong critic of the Rambam. Was he an integrationist? The Ravid?
The Ravid, good question. I suggest you read Isidore Twersky's book on the Ravid. It's a fantastic book. It was a PhD thesis at Harvard. And that will give you the answer to your question. The answer is, I would say no. I think it was not.
He said, great of mine believe in anthropomorphism.
Yes.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.